Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, January 17th, 2010, and this is show number 241. So, you know, I'm old. I'm not sure you realize that because of my youthful demeanor, but it's true. I can prove it, because I need reading glasses. Everyone else just gracefully goes out to Costco and buys a 10-pack of the ugly little reading glasses, and they distribute them around their house and office, and they move on with their lives. But this bugs the daylights out of me. Maybe it's because Steve mocks me every time I take my little peepers out. I'm not sure exactly, but that does get on my nerves. Tries to pretend that he's not old, too, but see, since he's only 4 hours younger than me, we all know that's not true. He also says he's not getting gray hair, and those are blonde hairs. But I ain't buying that either. And my friend Diane came up with an intriguing solution. We both have these nasty prescriptions with bad astigmatism, so we only get good distance vision with our contact lenses, not with regular glasses. So her solution was to get glasses that are actually clear in the middle and progressive lenses down below for close and mid-range vision. So, right, she wears glasses and contacts. I thought that sounded great. So I went to the eye doctor to get the same thing. You also need to realize, though, that I'm not authorized to choose my own glasses on my own. Jeannie at my eye doctor usually picks them out for me, but frequently my friend Nancy goes with me to help. The two of them sit there and they go back and forth and they decide what I'm allowed to wear. Well, this week, Nancy wasn't able to be there, so I thought, hey, I've got my iPhone with me. I should be able to do some live streaming to her. So I started out with Quick, that's Q-I-K if you haven't been there, and I set it to record. I turned the iPhone so the camera was facing me, then I called Nancy on my BlackBerry. This was a complete and utter fail. Turns out Quick didn't live stream, it just created a recording on my iPhone that I could later upload. Well, that's kind of lame. Even lamer is when I uploaded it, the movie never starts to play on Quick's website, even though the video still plays beautifully on my iPhone, and I can't upload it again because the iPhone app won't let me. All right, not to be daunted, we switched over to Ustream. Now, technically, I can't call this a complete fail, but it sure was dodgy. My image only moved every minute or so, but the audio was excellent. Except, of course, she was on the phone with me on my BlackBerry, so she didn't need audio. And technically, there was a picture, so she got to see my proposed glasses. It was an awful lot of bandwidth for a really stupid reason, and almost a complete failure. Like, I could have emailed her a good picture much, much faster, but it was fun to try and do it the geeky way. And Nancy was a great sport about it, too. Hey, if you're going to Macworld, be sure to send me an email so I can add you to the NoSilla Castaways Google Calendar. I've set up a meetup date and time and place. We're going to go to a place called Jillian's. It's right around the corner from the Moscone Center. We'll meet there around 6:30, right after the last big event on Thursday. I'll give more details to the folks who sign up for the calendar, so be sure to let me know if you're going to be there. Friday night, I had my good friend Pat Dingler over for dinner. You remember Pat. She's your Mac doctor, the one who kept me from jumping off a tall building after I set a magnet on top of the hard drive in my brand spanking new MacBook Pro while transferring all of my data over to it. Remember that? Well, anyway, I did a short interview with Pat that I think you might enjoy. So I have with me Pat Dingler, the famous Pat Dingler, the Mac doctor. How are you doing tonight, Pat?
Hey, Allison. Great to see you.
All right. I plied her with wine to get her to divulge some of the secrets of how she does hardware repair. See, I'm not a hardware guy. Hardware stuff scares me to death, and I just rely on Pat to fix my computers.
Great. Well, I'm a little bit of a hardware gal. I love doing it. When I was a kid, I used to take apart lights and things like that, but I didn't have this great method, and so getting them back together was more of a challenge. Then I just gave it to my dad. But now, I usually have the instructions on a piece of paper, or several pieces of paper. So
you only work on Macs, right? You don't...
Yes.
You'd have to wear gloves to not get a virus if you worked on a PC or something, right?
I don't even bring
them
in the house.
Okay, good. That's always best. So where do you go to get your instructions, first of all, for fixing a PC?
I fix it.
Mac.
Yeah.
Sorry.
iFixit.com is a great website, lots of resources, and they're really building it up quite a bit. So, more than just Macs. I mean, they've even
like iPods
recently
and stuff?
Taken apart an Android phone.
Ooh.
So, yeah, they've got all kinds of stuff, iPods, anything you can imagine.
Cool.
More than I would ever want to take apart. But
so you've done some pretty complex dissections. I mean, even for me, just to like replace a fan that Apple wouldn't do for less than $1,500 or $1,200.
Well, I guess complex is a relative term too, and different models, some are easier than others. I mean, it used to be much more complicated to switch out a hard drive, and now you just pretty much take out 2-3 screws and pull out the hard drive, put in a new one.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. But I don't hire you as often when I need a hard drive upgrade. I actually can do that because it's usually 3 screws, maybe a Torx screw in here somewhere. That's
exactly.
About it.
Yeah.
So I interrupted you as you were saying. So we were talking before dinner about what do you do with the 3,700 screws you got to take out? How do you deal with that problem of all the different screws? You said you throw them in a bowl.
Yeah, right.
Maybe not.
And then just get lucky with whatever comes up first. No, I'll print out the instructions, and often they'll be, you know, maybe 4 or 5 pages long. And I set them out on the table, and I will take Scotch double sticky tape, you know, it's sticky on both sides.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I just tape that over the diagram on the instructions.
Oh, no way.
And as soon as I take out a screw, I'll stick it right on that little double sticky tape.
Now, do
and
you do
then
it like
go
the
backwards.
Head down, or like, can you lay them down and they actually stick?
So long as they're not too tall, they'll head down, they'll stand up really
oh,
nicely.
Oh, how cute.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it.
And no stiff breezes in the house. And
don't open the door.
Exactly. And putting everything back together becomes easy as pie.
Wow, that's actually a hot tip, I think. My friend Nam uses ice cube trays.
But, I've used that,
or
too.
I've seen other people use ice cube trays. Nam actually, I said it wrong. It wasn't Nam. My friend Nam takes Ziploc bags that have label sections, and he writes down in script, you know, 3 screws, number 8, Torx, you know, was at step 27 kind of thing. So it takes about 17 hours to replace stuff, but he does a perfect job when he does it.
I'm a little lazier than that. I like it all right in front of me.
That's a great idea. I really like that.
Yeah, it came out of necessity. One of the first computers I opened up was an old one of the original MacBook Pros, and
those were nuts.
Oh my God!
Wait,
so
no, the iBook was the worst though, right?
Yeah, I never did an iBook. Believe it or not,
Namdar did an iBook for me. It took 3.5 hours to replace a hard drive. Now again, he's very very cautious, so maybe a regular person still like 2 hours though to replace a freaking hard drive.
They can be crazy, and those little screws, you do not want them to get away from you. I've dropped one once, and it was a nightmare finding it. Hands
now,
and knees.
This is going to be one of those old school stories, but I remember Steve bought had a digital watch early in the digital era, and the battery had died on it. So we went into JCPenney, and he gave it to the guy, said, yeah, no problem, I've got the battery. And he was working on replacing, he's putting it back together, and all of a sudden you see him go, wait, this doesn't work in audio.
Yeah.
He looks up over his head and he starts looking around, and then he starts like brushing his fingers through his hair, you know, and he starts digging around on the ground. We're like, oh man. And he goes, yeah, that screw got away from me. That's okay. That's okay. I've got another one. And he screws in the new one, and then he turns the watch over and it has cracked the LCD display. Back and which destroyed the watch, right? So the LCD has to be replaced. Now, back then, this was not a $4 throwaway like all digital watches are today. This was an expensive watch. So he sent it back to the factory, and the factory got flooded while it was there. This watch was doomed from birth, I think.
He was not meant to wear it.
No, I don't think so. But picking the wrong screw can have catastrophic effects.
You
can ground things, actually, right, if you do it wrong?
The worst that you could probably do, really, because they're really so short and they hardly interfere with anything else, you can just, you know, mess up the threads a little bit.
Strip it or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, in case there's people listening who are from the L.A. area, why don't you plug your site and your services for us?
Well, my site is www.yourmacdoctor.com. And I do all kinds of mostly software repair on the Mac side, some hardware repair, and troubleshooting and setting up.
Hand-holding,
lots of hand-holding, yes.
Well, what do you mean troubleshooting software on the Mac? That doesn't ever happen.
Well, every now and again we need to repair permissions or restore from a backup, things like that.
Okay. So would you suggest your service is real good if somebody doesn't want to take care of their dad's machine? You know,
absolutely.
It's a little less stress than taking care of it yourself kind of thing?
Yes, yes. Much less family strife.
I think so. Well, thanks, Pat. I appreciate you coming on the air with me.
Thanks for having me.
So it's altogether possible that I've mentioned before that I think video is hard. That really came to light this week with Steve and his new adventures in Final Cut Express. You may remember that he had to switch over to Final Cut Express because we got an HD camcorder, and that was a whole adventure in and of itself, but he's really starting to get going. With help from Don McAllister and Matt Hilliard, of course, he was able to get over the hump of actually getting started, pulling in the 3 hours of video he took on our trip to Mexico. In addition to his footage and my photos for the slideshow, that'll be another hour on the video, we also paid for a DVD of our ziplining adventure. They were very specific at Los Veranos Canopy Tours. Totally recommend them, by the way, in Puerto Vallarta. They were crazy fun. Anyway, these guys were very specific with us that we could take the photos and videos we bought and do anything we wanted with them. So first, Steve used Mac the Ripper to rip the DVD into VOB files on his Mac. I think that stands for video object files. It's the standard format that DVDs play, but not much else can do anything with it on your Mac. So next we had to turn the VOB files into something that Final Cut Express could read. Now there's a lot of different options, and many tools we found could create an MP4 file. But even if you encode the MP4 file with H.264, the best encoding algorithm out there today, you know, in terms of quality versus size, you're still compressing the video when you do that. So that would mean when he exports his three-hour tour movie, that same video will get compressed again, so it's really not ideal. And remember that when Canopy Tours put it on a DVD in the first place, they already compressed it once, so you'd end up compressing it three times. What he really wanted was to convert the VOB file to a DV file, otherwise known as digital video file, which I believe is uncompressed. It's huge anyway. Well, he started with Handbrake from handbrake.fr, which, according to what we'd read on the internet, should have been able to convert to DV format, but I think in that one it was actually grayed out. So up next, he tried MPEG Stream Clip from squared5.com, but it said that he'd have to go to Apple and buy the MPEG import tool. Now, that made no sense because MPEG Stream Clip was already able to import the VOB file just fine. It was export that it couldn't do. So we abandoned that whole track. We even tried VideoMonkey from videomonkey.org, the open source version of the wonderful visual hub that is no longer. But even VideoMonkey didn't have the VOB to DV output that Steve needed. Well, at this point in the story, Steve's getting pretty discouraged. Everything about his new workflow seems to be problematic, and he's not getting any joy out of video production now. I could tell something was not going well because he suddenly got very productive around the house. He replaced the carriage lights out in front. He bought new jacks at the hardware store so he could more easily rotate his tires. I told him it reminded me of when I had finals in college. I had the cleanest bathroom of anyone because I didn't want to go in and study for finals. Well, I didn't want to make his videos be like finals week. It's supposed to bring him joy. So we sat down together and started an exhaustive search for the tool to solve his problem. I am delighted to say that we found the solution, and we found it for free. First, I want to tell you, though, where we found it, because that's almost as important as what we found. Download.com is a site run by CNET, where they vet everything they post there. You can be sure if it's on CNET's download.com site, you know it's virus-free, it's a legitimate piece of software. Many products show an editor's rating, and all of them show user ratings. I trust download.com, especially if I'm recommending software to my Windows brethren. All right, enough teasing. The software we found to convert VOB to DV format is called FLV Crunch. It runs on Intel and PowerPC platforms from OS 10.1 through Snow Leopard. It had, 125,000 downloads so far, and it has a user rating of 3.5 out of 5 stars. When we were done, I gave it a 5 out of 5 and a rave review because it worked. So FLV Crunch has a crappy little OS 7 icon that it's actually kind of endearing. And oddly, the listed vendor site at download.com is geocities.com. This is odd for two reasons, because GeoCities was shut down just recently, and the link they give isn't even to a specific GeoCities account. It's just to geocities.com. You think, okay, well, maybe this software's old and crappy and hasn't been updated, but remember I said it was good for Snow Leopard? This software was updated on CNET's site just 5 days ago. It almost feels like they're playing a joke on me, and I just don't get it. Anyway, joke or not, the FLV Crunch window opens with a format pull-down containing MPEG 1 and 2, MP4, QuickTime's MOV, AVI, 3GP for mobile phones, our beloved DV digital video format, WMV, Flash and FLV, MP3 and AAC if you want to do audio only. Now that's a pretty darn good set of export formats. Next up, you can choose to wreck your video by messing with the frames per second and bit rates, which is always a great way to lose an afternoon. These options are not available on the DV output format, luckily. You can change the resolution if you like, or tell FLV Crunch to keep the original value. It also comes with a few standard presets. It has iPod, high def, standard def, and VGA, and that's it. Now, that's not a lot of options compared to something like Handbrake or Visual Hub or Video Monkey. With those, you get things like iPhone, Apple TV. I think they even have Zoom in there. So, you know, if you need that kind of flexibility, you might want to stick with one of those tools. But remember, all we wanted were those two little characters, DV. So, next up, add the source files, set a destination folder, and you're done. Steve threw in his VOB files, and it did take a while, but he got his DV files out at last. And that's when things got worse. He dropped the DV files into Final Cut Express, and instead of the perfectly good soundtrack that was on the DV files, which, by the way, we tested in QuickTime before we did the import to Final Cut Express. So now we're really discouraged. We've been at this for hours and hours by this time. He's going to start cleaning or fixing something again if I don't find something. Well, luckily, the interwebs were on our side yet again. It turns out there's some weird thing with Final Cut Express that sometimes it has to be kind of kickstarted to render the audio correctly. A simple command R and then a reasonable wait, and the audio was in there perfectly. Whew. Well, it's been a long road to travel for Steve, but I dearly hope we're over the hump now and he can have fun with video production again. Stay tuned. All right, we're really going to change gears here now. For Christmas, I got a terrific book called The Presentation Secrets of Steve Jobs by Carmine Gallo. I heard about it first on The Real Deal, episode 181, when Tom Merritt and Rafe Needleman interviewed Carmine Gallo about his book. It's a great episode of The Real Deal, and if you haven't seen or heard the show, you really should go check it out. It's one of the CNET podcasts, and I put a link in the show notes, of course. The reason I'm bringing up this book is because it's fascinating. We all know about the reality distortion field that Steve Jobs creates when he does a presentation, but I always assumed it was something they pushed through the ventilation system or something. I'm sure they do that at the Apple store, by the way, because I saw a guy once minding his own business. He's walking down the mall, and suddenly his body whipped sideways, and he flew into the Apple store. Okay, sure, it's possible he just noticed he was about to pass his intended destination, but I think it was the reality distortion field just coming out of the store. So anyway, Carmine Gallo has clearly spent a lot of time studying the method Steve Jobs uses to create his dynamic and passionate presentations. And he actually breaks them down into practical steps you can follow to try and create some of the magic Steve brings to his speech. I'm about to do some presentations in my day job to some really big audiences. And while that doesn't give me the cold chills normal people get at the thought, you have figured out at this point I like to be the center of attention, right? Anyway, even though I'm not terrified or anything, I still figure I can improve my techniques. In particular, I refuse to ever again give a PowerPoint presentation with a white background, black text, and bullet form with long sentences. I'm just not going to do it. I learned that from the book. I'm also not going to just start throwing in gimmicky fly-in slides, a twirl to get attention and throw people off the message. That's not exactly what I mean. Instead, I'm going to learn from Carmine Gallo and Steve Jobs how to more effectively draw in my audience and impart on them some of the enthusiasm I have for my topics. Luckily, the hardest part is easy for me. Carmine says that you have to be passionate about your topic. Since I only pick subjects about which I'm passionate, that's easy. If I'm not excited about something, I simply refuse to stand up and talk about it. And I also even refuse to take on assignments about things that don't excite me. I know everyone doesn't have that luxury, but for some reason, I've gotten away with it for over 30 years so far. I know this book is working because I can't sleep after I've been reading it. I find myself going over and over ideas for my talks, working on taglines, thinking of ways to get rid of material on my slides to get that Zen simplification and things. If you do any kind of presentations and you'd like to see if you can better capture the imagination of your audience and suck them into your madness, I highly recommend The Presentation Secrets of Steve Jobs by Carmine Gallo. Have I ever mentioned how much I love shareware developers? I really, really do love them. I had two experiences this week that continue to cement that opinion. Back on show number 206 in May of last year, I reviewed an application called Zoom 2. It has three O's for some reason. The main thing I use Zoom 2 for is the ability to move a window by grabbing it anywhere. You'd be amazed how often you'll use this if you buy Zoom 2. My Twitter client du jour, for example, Twirl, frequently misbehaves and falls off the screen where I simply can't grab the top of it. But no worries, since Zoom 2 is running in the background, a quick little key combo, I can grab it anywhere. Anyway, the reason I bring this up again is I was having one annoyance with Zoom 2. The developer, John Clayton, updates this product pretty often, which is very cool. But every single time I get an update, I have to re-enter my license code. It was driving me berserk. So finally, after about the 15th time, I wrote him an email. He got back to me instantly, and he explained that this has been driving him crazy too, because he can't replicate it. He's had a few people have the same problem, but because he can't make it happen on his end, he hasn't been able to figure out what the root cause is. He very politely asked me if I had the energy to do some experiments for him, running logging so we could crack the code on this problem. Well, you know me. It's like asking me if I wanted a hot fudge sundae. Of course I would play. We did about 25 experiments, writing back and forth as I ran the tests and sending log files, and in the end, the problem went away, which was very aggravating because, of course, we didn't solve it for anyone else. But the main point of my story is that instead of being annoyed by some whiny user, John was delighted I'd written, apologetic that I had problems, and asked for my help with the product. That, to me, is perfection. Anyway, let me give him another plug. Check out Zoom 2 at coderage-software.com. In this case, I love the software, but I've actually met the loveliest people when I didn't even like their software sometimes. Gracious and understanding people and truly wanting to learn what they could do to improve. The second example is Mike Yenko from Yenko.com, who wrote a product called iKeeper. I did a review of iKeeper over on Tim Verporten's Mac ReviewCast this week. Should totally go check it out. It's a cool little app. Well, I had one little question about the software, and I wrote to Mike. He wrote back this like two-page letter to me explaining his philosophy and what he developed, told me how much he adores Mac and Mac podcasts. He had me at that point. It wasn't so much about the product, but it was just delightful to get to know someone this way. The Mac community really does rock, you know? They say that a picture says a thousand words, but we all know video can be even more powerful. So what if you could teach people things using words, pictures, and video? You can do that with the latest version of ScreenSteps from ScreenSteps.com. You can write specific instructions explaining the why of each step, drop in an image showing the exact menu you're talking about, and then embed a video screencast so you can really dig into the complexities of your subject. You'll be a hero with your coworkers, your employees, and your customers. I even use ScreenSteps to teach relatives so I don't have to repeat things over and over and over again. Instead, I give them a ScreenSteps document and they can pull it out every time they forget what I taught them. For only $40 for the standard version or $80 for the pro version of ScreenSteps, you can have this kind of fun at your house too. Heck, knock off 25% using the coupon code NOSILLA. It's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, and it's even less expensive. Don't forget to check out the educational and enterprise licensing too. Get on over to ScreenSteps.com and buy it. So are you old enough to remember MechDraw? It was a vector-based drawing program for the Mac that was wildly popular from the first Macintosh in 1984. It was upgraded to MechDraw Pro in the 1990s, now with color. And then Claris got a hold of it and mutated it into Claris Draw, and it pretty much lost favor with the Mac community. Oddly, it didn't seem to fall out of favor because there was something better out there, but just because it was missing features compared to the older versions. Ask any old fart Mac user about MacDraw, and they'll get misty-eyed on you thinking back to those delightful days. Well, I called MacDraw a vector-based drawing program. What that means is you're drawing circles, lines, and boxes that are not just bitmap pixels on the page, but rather can be dragged around and have their shapes changed after the fact. Well, I have good news for you. There may finally be a replacement for our beloved MacDraw. Purgatory Design at purgatorydesign.com has a product called Intaglio that they bill as the MacDraw we've all been looking for. The folks at Purgatory Design have been developing for the Mac since 1984 under different names, so I think they might actually be in it for the long haul. I did my usual poke around and press buttons method when I first got Intaglio, And then I added this crazy new technique I've been trying out lately. I know it's kind of wild, but I've started to read the manuals. I know it's kind of off the wall, but you wouldn't believe how much good information you can find in there sometimes. Well, let's start with the results of my poking around method, and then we'll get into more depth from the manual. Intaglio has a beautifully simple interface, but do not let that fool you. You get a nice big area to draw with grid lines on by default, and then a row of tools down the left and some modifiers across the top. Very standard looking, and you can get started drawing little simple boxes and circles and arrows immediately. Right away, you notice one thing nice. As you draw, you'll get little alignment lines popping up to show you when you've drawn something parallel or lined up with another object on the page. I love that. It's something you get with applications like OmniGraffle. Well, almost immediately after I drew my first object, I noticed that in addition to the normal arrow tool for pointing at things and moving them around, there's another arrow that I can only best describe as saying it's hollow. I actually think it's a magic arrow. When you have this arrow selected, you could do some amazing transformations of your objects. Let me give you an example. Let's say you draw a rectangular box. Click on the hollow arrow, and the corners of the box will change their little handles from being solid markers to hollow ones. Now click and drag on one of the hollow handles, and the corner will change into a curve, morphing as you move your cursor around. So now it's curvy, and you also get a tangent line that you can rotate, changing the shape of the curve too. I put a picture in the show notes that might help you understand what I'm talking about. It's actually called a Bezier curve. So, you think that's fun? Grab the shape tool that's a star, and you can mess with all the points on it, where it doesn't even vaguely resemble a star at all when you're done. In the modifier buttons across the top of the window, there's a shear button that lets you change a rectangle into a parallelogram. Hope you guys paid attention to high school geometry. It was my favorite class in school. Anyway, you got arcs, free-form shapes, line drawings. All of these are traditional at first, but then they're set free by the Intaglio magic. I know I'm sounding maudlin, but the phrase keeps coming into my head. What I keep thinking as I play with Intaglio is complete freedom. You get complete freedom to mess with what you did. I drew a free line with the pencil tool, and then I thought, I wonder what these scissors do. I was able to cut the line and then move the ends independently, so I had two curves in space, like you had a string on the ground and you cut it, and you can move the ends where you'd cut it. But interestingly enough, they were essentially still one shape because they all moved together with shear or rotation or location pointers. This complete freedom even works with text. Put in text with the text tool, and you can change what's called the kern. Now, I'd heard the term kern before, but it wasn't until Intaglio that I actually understood what it meant. Because as you slide the little kern slider in Intaglio, it changes the distance between the characters. Now, I've wasted countless hours of my life trying to get text to fit inside other objects. If I could have just pushed the kern in a smidge, I would have been so happy. When I was thinking about the complete freedom, it reminded me of Tom Terrific, that little cartoon that played during Captain Kangaroo in the 1960s. Tom was a simple line-drawing character, along with his wonder dog Manfred, but because of his magic funnel hat, he could transform himself into any shape. All right, I'm back to the old geezer talk again, aren't I? But anyway, Intaglio did remind me of Tom Terrific, because you could bend and shape and move things any way you wanted. Adding a gradient to an object is just a push of a button. Figuring out how to change the colors for the gradient was a bit trickier. Turns out that under the window menu, you can turn on and off about 8 gazillion palettes for modifying just about anything you can imagine. Opening up the gradient palette lets me choose the two colors and whether it's a linear or radial gradient. Once you're in that palette, you'll notice all the options to work with. Say, you could put a pattern instead of a gradient, or a solid color, or even a texture if you prefer. What really excites me about Intaglio is the smooth transition from the completely pedestrian tools to options that stretch your imagination on what you could create with Intaglio. Maybe I was just going to draw a layout of my office with Intaglio, but pretty soon I'd be putting in textures on the chair drawing and adding wood grain to my desk, I bet. By the way, drawing my office layout in MacDraw Pro was the single main use that I actually miss MacDraw Pro for. I've been stuck doing it in PowerPoint of all things. Oh, the horror. Well, you do realize at this point that I've only told you what I figured out from simply poking around. Digging into the help file was another joy. The folks at Purgatory Design have done a fabulous job of documentation. Every tool is explained first with a graphic showing you what tool they're talking about. Now, don't you hate it when they say things like in documentation, like grab the combabulator tool and then all you do is, but they don't tell you what the combabulator tool even looks like? Well, not so with Intaglio. See, with Intaglio, they show you the little icon, then you show you the modifier options, and they give a clear explanation of how you would use the tool. There's a freehand tool for sketching paths, both straight lines and those lovely Bezier curves. There's a path tool, which is slightly different. It actually creates open or closed objects that can be filled, but created with complete irregularity. Rather than mutating a rectangle like I did, just start with complete freedom. Well, I can tell I'm not going to be able to explain everything here. Just the star tool alone is crazy. You can define how many points the star has, the inside radius, and whether the outside and inside points have loops. Think like curly cues as it goes around. Anyway, back to arcs again. I challenge you to try and draw an arc that's exactly like what you want with PowerPoint. Seriously, think how much of an arc you want to draw and try to do it. We'll wait here. Now, we're not going to wait. That's going to take too long. All right, the only time I didn't have immediate joy was in using the dimension tool. This is a tool you use if you want to draw single straight segments with the dimension showing, like in a drafting program. For some reason, it would not automatically line up the endpoints for me or indicate when things were getting close, like I described in the early part of this review. I was trying to get lines to touch each other. Oh well, so Intaglio is not a good drafting tool. I can live with that. The measurement tool works great, at least. You can measure across any kind of object really easily. Great for that office layout. As I kept reading the manual, I discovered that what I was thinking was complete freedom, that was actually the restricted world of Intaglio. Start holding down the Option key while you're messing with your graphics, and you'll find out what real freedom is all about. Draw an arc, then hold down the Option key, and as you drag the points, it's as though you're moving it around in 3D. It's wild, I tell you. Oh, I thought that was wild until I read about masking. Objects move forward and back just like in PowerPoint in the good old days of McDraw, and they can be grouped. So draw one object, draw another one partially covering it, and then group them together. When you turn on the mask function, the only part of the lower object you can see is the part that's directly under the upper object. I found one thing I couldn't figure out how to do with this. I wanted to take a circle and cut a quadrant out of it. I know you could just make it with an arc, but I wanted to try to do it using the mask. It's sort of the inverse of what masking does, though, because it would only show the quadrant if I put a rectangle over a circle. Sure, well, there's a way to do it with masking. I haven't gotten to it yet. It's going to keep bugging me. I'm sure there's some way to make this happen. Of course, like I said, I could just use the arc tool. Intaglio imports graphics from a ton of different things. You can import EPS, vector files, PDFs, images, and text. You can export PDF, PICT, TIFF, EPS, and whatever linkback connections are. If you got some of those old MacDraw files lying around, Intaglio will import them. It'll take in MacDraw 2 and MacDraw Pro, and it'll convert them to Quartz graphics so you can continue to do your old work. The one thing I didn't like about Intaglio was that I could not figure out an easy way to use the same tool twice in a row. If you draw a circle, for example, the cursor changes to the pointer right after you finish drawing the first circle, so you have to click the circle again. I tried double-clicking, and then I tried right-clicking, but all I saw was this silly choice of lock, which I just ignored. I kept ignoring it and being irritated throughout the review. And then, of course, I tried seeing what lock did, and of course, it did exactly what I wanted. It let me create multiple objects of the same type. I can't find anything wrong with this tool. Anyway, a simple right-click on the object to lock or unlock, or the even more intuitive escape key will unlock the tool as well. So, yeah, the only thing I didn't like, it was just me. I was an idiot. Anyway, it's extremely rare for me to actually be this thrilled with a tool, but I am enchanted by Intaglio. I tried really hard to find something wrong, and other than having a tidbit of trouble with the dimension tool, the darn thing was perfect. They even support key commands to switch tools. And get this, Intaglio even lets you play if you have a PowerPC Mac. Intaglio is $89. Now, while that's pretty expensive for a shareware land, this is a fabulous vector drawing tool that performs flawlessly, and I'm pretty certain I have only scraped the surface of what Intaglio can do. Head on over to purgatorydesign.com and try out the free demo. Learn everything you want with the demo, You just can't save your drawings or export from Intaglio without buying it. If you print from the demo, you get an unlicensed watermark. You can really run Intaglio through its paces without buying it and make sure it's everything you want it to do before you put down your hard-earned money. I have only one question to ask before I finish up with Intaglio. How is it that this fantastic tool has been out for over 2 years and nobody ever told me about it before? I'm really excited because my friend Adam found me a new iPod adapter for my car. Years ago, Steve put in a unit that sits under my seat. It connects into the back of my built-in stereo head unit, and then it lets me connect an iPod or my iPhone through a dock connector to play podcasts. And I mean, I guess if someone else were driving, they could play music. And it all comes out through the stereo. I know it's sad, but I have a Dolby 5.1 stereo system in my car, and I play mono MP3 files compressed at 64 kilobits per second. But hey, makes me happy, right? I guess I should explain why I want a new one if this one is so great. The one I have is pretty restrictive on how you can use it. You have to queue up on the iPod what you want to play, then plug in the dock connector, and then it'll play. All of the controls are locked once it's plugged in. The only way you can stop and start the iPod is by turning the radio on and off. And that's actually the only thing you can do. You can't rewind, switch to another show, you can't even change the volume of the input from the iPod. I've tolerated that over the years and become accustomed to the restrictions, but when I got a new iPod Nano for Christmas, it wouldn't charge through the dock on the car like the old second generation Nano could. That means I'm constantly having to find time to charge it, which is really boring. I mentioned this to my friend Adam, and he found a unit from a company called Soundgate being sold by LogjamElectronics.com that works on Hondas from 2003 to 2010 and Acuras, and oddly, the Goldwing motorcycle series of the same years. This new unit will let me display text from the iPod on the radio. I'm not sure, but I think it might display on the navigation system as well. I can control the iPod using the iPod while it's connected. It will charge when plugged into the car, too. It's $170 from Logjam Electronics, but it's got no tax and no shipping, so that makes it a bit more palatable. The first thing I did after Adam found it for me was write an email to Honda Bob to find out if he'd install it for me. I know, Steve could do it, but it just isn't a happy experience for him. He loves the outcome of projects like this, but there is zero joy in the middle of it. Honda Bob, on the other hand, does this kind of thing for fun, I think, and for money. But why not let Steve play with his video and let Bob play with my car? You might have thought Honda Bob was only there to change the oil and fix the power steering unit, but he does so much more. He has a terrific website at hdabob.com where he explains how all the parts of the car work. He tells interesting travel stories, too, from his years on the road fixing people's Hondas and Acuras at their own homes. If you live in the LA or Orange County areas, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, it's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. How are you this fine evening in Ireland, Bart?
Just a bit sort of coldy. Yeah. Seem to have picked one up with all the icky weather we've had.
Yeah, is it still nasty there? Or?
It's changed.
Well, we've gone from black ice before.
Yeah, from everything's frozen to everything's underwater.
Oh, no.
So let's talk of flooding again on the radio and stuff. Not as bad as last time, but, you know.
Hey, we're supposed to have evacuated rain 5 days in a row, or 3 or 4 or 5 days in a row here.
Like oh, no.
Over an inch a day. That's actually
quite a lot.
Yeah, that's actually pretty massive for us. Yeah. Considering we get like 12 inches a year, it's going to be a nightmare.
No, the ironic thing we have here is that there's actually loads of parts of the country without water while they're also flooded because all the frost has bust water mains and things. Oh, so all the reservoirs basically emptied out. And now they have no water in the tap and too much water not in the tap.
Can you put a bucket outside?
I suppose that'd work. I just wouldn't scoop it up. I'd collect it on the way down.
As I recall, you had a very exciting birthday.
Yeah, it must have been... Actually, while we were talking last time, unbeknownst to me, in the attic, the ice had made its way into our pipes and had blocked the main water input into the tank in the attic. And the way things work in Ireland is that all water in the house, with the exception of the tap in the kitchen, is fed from a tank in the attic because we generally don't have very good water pressure. So you let the water dribble into the tank, which is a big reservoir, and then you get, you know, that gives the pressure for the house. And then if, you know, you run a shower, you probably use, you know, a quarter of the tank. And then over the next half hour, it fills back up again, and it's not a problem. But if you were to have your shower straight off the mains, it'd be a very unpleasant affair.
Dribbly, huh?
Very dribbly. Oh, the only reason then that the kitchen tap is not done from the tank is for hygiene reasons, because you don't want standing water for drinking.
What about the bathroom tap?
Bathroom tap would come from the tank.
Hmm. So you can brush your teeth with standing water, but just don't drink it directly?
I wouldn't. I mean, when I'm brushing my teeth, I tend to spit it back out, especially when I use mouthwash afterwards. So I don't think it's an issue.
Oh, good deal. So what happens when that tank freezes?
Or, well, the tank, that tank freezes. Well, I don't think the whole tank froze. I think it's just the water pipe that fed the tank froze. But unbeknownst to me, I was on ticking time bomb of not having any water.
Oh, because if that line is frozen, nothing's coming in?
Yeah, so you use the tank and you're all completely blissfully unaware that anything's wrong until you get to the bottom of the tank. And then suddenly all the water stops. So I put on a wash.
So how do you unfreeze that line?
We opened up the hatch to the attic, stuck a big electric heater under it, and tried to get as much hot air up there as we could.
Oh, my gosh.
Probably cost us a fortune in an electric heater overnight, but the next morning... I'm not sure whether it was our electric heater or whether it was the fact that the weather broke and it started to thaw the next day, but by lunchtime the next day, there was this massive gushing sound of water racing into a completely empty tank.
Oh, wonderful. Beautiful noise to wake up to, huh?
Oh, I'm telling you, it was like something from heaven, the sound of running water. Like, yay!
Ironic that water does come from heaven, right?
Yeah, I suppose it is, actually, yeah.
You know, Justin Byrne from MacCrack was here right when this was happening to you, and he told us that he discovered something odd at his mother's house, is that he always parked in the same place, and then he went away for a couple of weeks, and her water main froze. And they figured out that the car sitting over it was what had been keeping it from freezing all that time. Because it was insulating it directly above it. And so they had to go get somebody else's car and put it over it. And they actually sat and ran the car. You talk about inefficient heating. It did the unfreezing job, so.
Well, that's all right. My landlord was saying that he knew where his water pipe was close to the surface. So we lit little bonfires in a line along where the pipe was to get his water running again.
Oh, jeez. I guess you do what you do. Gotta do, right?
Yeah, I'm just glad that, I mean, you know, as bad as the rain and the wind is, at least, you know, the frost was really getting on my nerves.
It doesn't sound any fun. Well, this week in plumbing is concluded. Let's get to Security Light.
Yeah, so quite a busy Security Light. Just starting off with a quick follow-up. Last week we said Patch Tuesday was coming. Well, shock horror, this week Patch Tuesday has been. just the one bulletin. Critical for Windows 2000 and not really all that critical for anyone else, but no harm in running the update anyway. So wake up your VMs, run the update, put them back to sleep. Or if you're a Windows user, just run the update.
A nice quiet month, huh?
From the Microsoft point of view. For Adobe, on the other hand, did not have such a quiet month.
Okay.
Actually, in Microsoft's month got a bit more interesting near the end of the week as well. This is a complete case of deja vu, but another big 0 day in Adobe's PDF-based products. So Reader and whatever that other one is, Acrobat or something.
Right.
So again, all versions, remote code execution, all that kind of carry on. And it has been reported that this is one of the ways that the Chinese hackers were attacking Google and the other American corporations this week.
Great. So that's how they helped, huh?
Yeah, that's how they helped. So
I'm not sure anything would have kept those hackers out, but glad to know Adobe was there to help.
Yeah. So if you're running any of those Adobe products, consider not running any of those Adobe products. But unless you may have a really good reason to, in which case, fair enough. But definitely update them if you continue to run them.
So we should talk a little just for a second about alternatives. On Windows, a good alternative is called Foxit Reader. If you check that out, it's not got any Adobe code in it. So that's a free alternative for you. And on the Mac, I don't know why anybody would load it with Preview built in.
Yeah, I think the Mac has better PDF support than most of those Adobe products.
If you have to create PDFs, then you got to start being a little more creative. And I don't know too much about what I'd recommend there.
Not in OS X, you don't. Just click print.
No, but I mean, some people create PDFs, you know, with chapter marker, all these crazy things, you know. It's a little different than just printing.
You can do a scarily large amount of that kind of thing, though.
Oh, well, good. I don't know enough about it to comment. But anyway, just want to mention Foxit Reader was a good solution.
Yeah, because, of course, Windows users don't have native PDF support in their operating system.
Right. Actually, that's another thing. There's PDF Creator, which is a sort of a plugin sort of thing that does give you the print to PDF capability. So, yes. You know, I don't believe in actually printing any documents that I can help from printing. So I always print to PDF using PDF Creator. So I'll put a link to PDF Creator and Foxit Reader, both in the show notes.
Cool. Then continuing our theme of ways in which Chinese hackers break into American companies, we have a zero-day exploit in Microsoft Internet Explorer.
Yay!
Yay! It's apparently the actual exploit code is available in all versions of IE, right up to and including IE8. But because of address space layout randomization, ASLR, in Vista and Windows 7, it's much more difficult for the bad guys to actually do anything with the exploit in those later versions of Windows. But in XP and 2K, that's not the case. So it's really easy pickings in those older operating systems.
Nice.
There is no fix. So don't use IE.
Not even IE8. Wow.
Well, as I say, you're much safer because, you know, the flaw is there, but the bad guys find it very hard to do anything with it. So you could take your chances if you wanted. But I have to say, I'd just be inclined to use Firefox or Chrome or Safari or Opera if you really feel like it.
Living on the edge, huh?
Okay. Yeah, I never did get the Opera thing. Anyway.
So you'll let us know when those patches come through so it's safe to go back in the water?
Sure. I always keep an eye on these things, yeah. And then finally, now, I would like to think that none of our listeners could ever possibly be the victims of phishing attacks because they're all very smart people and they always look at these things and they're always ever-present vigilance and all that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, just to point out that there is a spate of phishing attacks targeted at MobileMe customers.
Oh.
And they seem to be using the domain apple-bills.com.
Hmm.
Which is slightly believable because it does contain the word Apple.
Ah, yeah. Remind people how they can tell what is the character. Where do they have to look to see if it's fake or real?
It's something dot something. So the last two are the most significant. And apple.com is apples, but apple-bills, the dash is not a dot. So apple-bills could be anyone.
It's the last two things before the slash, right? The whatever dot whatever. That's what you really care about. Everything else is fake.
Yeah, so if it was apple.something.com, it'd be fake. But in this case, it's just something which contains the word apple.com, not pure apple.com. So actually, it's quite sneaky, because by sticking in apple-bills, it looks semi-legitimate. So they're being classic
phishing thing. So what does this thing do to you?
It gives you a little thing that looks awfully like Apple's interface and says, "Here, please give me your credit card details." And well, that's all they want, really.
And don't.
Yeah, don't, exactly. So it's just really to keep people aware of it. There's screenshots and things in the article linked in the show notes.
Okay.
But,
good.
Yeah, just be vigilant. That's all I'll say.
As always.
Exactly. So.
All right.
I think that's all of our...
That's it for security? Well, actually, our next subject is a little bit on security, so it's a smooth transition into the next subject, right?
Yes, so that's it for security light, and now we're into a security suggestion, or tip, or I don't know what you want to call it. But it's sort of a follow-on from our ongoing theme of talking about people who run their own WordPress installs, because we seem to have a lot of people who do that.
Yeah, surprising number.
Yeah, because we thought initially when we started talking WordPress we might annoy people, but we didn't. People said they liked it, so we kept going.
All right, so what set us up with the problem to be solved here first?
Okay, the chances are, if you run your own WordPress install, you're logging into it without HTTPS.
Oh. I guess I should have noticed that.
Yeah, I was always actually waiting for you to notice this as we were going along. I didn't mention it because I didn't have a solution, but now I do, so I'm mentioning it.
Very good, because that is the rule of security light. You're not allowed to scare us unless you have a solution.
Yeah, now this solution is a little more tricky than many things we talk about. But anyway, so because you're not using HTTPS, any man in the middle could read your username and password as they fly by. So you can choose to live with that risk. But if you do live with that risk, I would make some suggestions. The first one is to use a username and password combination for WordPress that you don't use anywhere else. So that if someone sniffs it and gets it, the only thing they get is your WordPress.
Which is a catastrophe, but not of monumental proportions.
Yeah, you can log into your own hosting account and you can nuke it and create a new one and restore from one of your backups. I mean, you still control your hosting account, so if someone gets at your WordPress, then you just nuke that WordPress and do it again.
Even though in WordPress they could go in and lock you out, you can destroy WordPress. You can scrape it off and start over. Okay, good point. This would be why when I shared my username and password with you for when I was on vacation, you said, using the same one. Good job, Allison.
I was obviously being quite sarcastic when I said that.
Yeah, oops.
If you're going to keep using it, be aware of the risk and bear that in mind, and simply have a password that's only used for WordPress and not used for anything else. And also consider restricting the places that you actually update your WordPress from to your house and not doing it when you're out and about, because that's just extra risky.
Right, right. If you're at your house, you don't have a man in the middle, though, right? Can that mean you're pretty safe?
Conceivably some naughty person could take over your ISP's DNS server.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there are still ways they could get you. It's just more difficult. And at the end of the day, if you're an opportunistic attacker, you're more likely to be sitting in Starbucks than you are driving around random places.
It's sort of like it's really easy to steal someone's credit card info from their mailbox kind of a thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's not risk-free to do it from home, but it's a lot safer than doing it from out and about.
Okay.
So you can choose to live with the risk. Or there's the obvious, simple solution. If the problem is that you're logging in over HTTPS, then don't. And log in over HTTP, then don't. And log in over HTTPS instead.
Okay, how do I do that?
Yeah, exactly. So in order to do that, you will need to have something called an SSL cert, or a secure socket layer certificate. And that has to be installed into your web server. Hmm. Now, if you're running your own, you can guarantee without a shadow of a doubt that you can do this. But if you're on a shared hosting package, like 99.9% of our listeners probably are.
And me.
Then it's going to depend on who your provider is, whether or not they'll allow this, and how exactly they would support it.
Okay.
One thing that is for sure, though, SSL requires a dedicated IP address. So if you're not paying for a dedicated IP address, you're going to have to. That much is certain. Now, this is usually something quite insignificant, like $10 a year kind of thing.
Oh.
It's not usually a huge wadge of cash.
Okay.
Now, if they do support SSL, there is a non-zero possibility that they say, sure, you can have SSL, but you have to buy it from us. And if they say that, well, then you're kind of stuck.
Okay.
And the chances are that if they do say that, they're not going to say that'll be €5 a year. They're going to say that'll be €100 a year, probably. In which case, you may decide, you know something, I don't care.
Why would they charge so much? I mean, that doesn't normally cost that kind of money, does it?
Oh, SSL certs are expensive.
Oh, they are?
Yeah. That's normal.
Now,
that's the problem.
So exactly what is an SSL cert? That's something that proves that I am me? Or that my site is me?
Well, that your site is your site.
Okay.
So if a site has an SSL cert, then you can be sure that it is who it says it is. So I really am talking to podfeet.com. So no man in the middle has put themselves in between. No one has spoofed my DNS and sent me off to their server instead. No one can read the traffic between me and you. That's what it gives me. It means that whatever the server sends and I send is what arrives. I really am talking to who I think I'm talking to, and no one else can see what I'm doing. They're the three things you get from SSL Secure.
Okay. So the only time you see that that certificate is invalid or expired or whatever is when you're going to an HTTPS server, right?
Yeah, because if there's no HTTP, there are no certs.
You mean if there's no HTTPS?
Sorry, yeah. If it's just HTTP, there are no certs.
Okay. All right.
That only comes in once you go to the S.
Okay.
So in order to do SSL, you need to have a certificate. And so, as I say, I would start because it's different for everyone. If you're lucky, your provider will have a little control panel that says, please upload your private key here, and please upload your certificate here, and then you're finished. Or they may say, well, here is your private key. Now, you got to go and give this to the people who make the certificate. And I mean, there's a million and one ways it could be, so there's no point in my going into every possible way they could do it.
Okay.
But you just need to contact support and ask the question, can I supply my own cert? And if I can, how? And they will give you instructions, and you just follow them.
Okay. But where am I going to get that cert from?
Exactly. So being able to actually upload a cert is step one, but the other obvious step is getting a cert. But there's no point in going on to the getting a cert bit if the answer from your hosting provider is no, sorry, sod off. it's kind of pointless.
Okay.
So you could go to people like VeriSign and stuff and pay very large amounts of money for a cert, and that would have many advantages, that it would be a cert recognized by every browser and all sorts of stuff. I mean, you know, if you're paying $1,000 for a cert from a highly trusted company, you can rest assured that every single browser in the world is going to have that certificate's root cert as a trusted cert, and it's going to work everywhere completely flawlessly, and, you know, you get what you pay for. But in the case of WordPress, we're not actually trying to give everyone visiting our site a secure access. We're only interested in giving ourselves secure access.
So we can control what browser we go with and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so if we end up with a cert that isn't automatically trusted by your browser, that's not actually a big deal.
Right.
No one, if you were running a shop and trying to sell stuff, that just wouldn't fly.
Sure.
Because no user would actually say, oh, sure, I'll trust this cert. But you can add your own cert to your own browser, even if the browser doesn't automatically trust it, and then you have absolutely all the protections that you would from any other cert.
Okay.
So a free way to get yourself a cert, with the caveat that it won't be automatically recognized by all browsers, is to go to startssl.com and follow their instructions.
Hmm. Why do they do it for free?
I don't know.
Okay. I mean, everybody charges a fortune and they just do it for free because they...
Yeah, but their root certificate isn't trusted by all browsers.
Oh,
apparently
okay.
It is trusted by some. It just wasn't trusted by Firefox or Safari, so that was enough to tell me it wasn't a runner to run a shop off.
Okay, all right.
But, you know, they do also offer more enterprise-y stuff, more high-level stuff for people who do pay. But in fairness, their prices are very low, even for the more fancy stuff.
So let's be clear, though. So what happens when you get it and it says, I don't trust this cert, you have the option of saying, yes, I want you to trust this cert. And then you're okay,
so
right?
In Firefox, that's called, you add an exception, it's called. So you just click trust this cert, add a permanent exception. And then it will keep that cert on file. So if some bad guy tricks you and uses a different fake cert or a different unrecognized cert, your browser is still going to give an error because it's not the cert it added as an exception.
Okay.
Safari will also give you an error, and you have to. It's a little more tricky in Safari, but basically it pops up that says certificate mismatch, and then you click a button that says show certificate, and it gives you way more detail then. So it starts off as a teeny tiny little pop-up window, and you click the show cert, and it becomes much bigger. And then there's a drop-down there called trust, and you click on that, and you see a few more options then. One of those options is basically it says, you know, what do I do when I meet this cert, and you can change it to always trust.
Okay, great.
And click OK. And then you're going to be asked to enter your password, because what it's actually doing is it's adding a system-wide exception for that cert.
So now the importance of this is that you're going to, you do all that. Now, if you ever see that warning again, you know something's rotten in Denmark. You know that your DNS
exactly.
by your ISP has gotten compromised or some...
Somehow, someone has sent you to the wrong place.
Right.
Because your computer now has your cert, and your web server has your cert, so you should never see an error again.
But make sure you don't say, oh, well, that's right, Bart said I was going to see this new certificate thing,
yeah,
so I'll
you
click OK.
Once.
Trust. Yeah, you don't want to click
it
the second time.
You click it once, and you trust it once, and from then forward, if it gives you an error again, there is something rotten in the state of Denmark.
Right.
Now, the nice thing, when if you do it in Safari, is it's system-wide. So that means that if you're using a client like, say, Mars Edit will also trust the cert now.
Oh, that's cool. And it gets that trust from your browser, or you do it in Mars Edit?
No. Mars Edit uses the standard OS X components, So when you add it in Safari, you're actually adding it to the standard OS X components. So anything that uses standard OS X components now has that cert. Firefox doesn't use standard OS X anything. It has its own of everything, which is why I have to add it separately to Firefox.
Oh, okay. Got you.
Mars Edit, slightly annoyingly, and the same goes for Fluid, I've discovered, they don't actually pop up a message. They just give up. They go, oh, cert doesn't work. Good day. So, but once you've added the exception in Safari, it becomes system-wide, and it then is accepted by all the other apps, including Mars Edit.
Okay. All right, well, I guess my first call is to GoDaddy, then.
Yeah, and see if it's possible. At the end of the day, it's a trade-off between, first off, everyone knows the risk, so you choose, I accept this risk, or I don't accept this risk. And then you decide, is it worth the effort, or am I just going to accept the risk?
Okay.
So, I mean, I'm not going to tell people you have to do this. You just have to be aware of the risks and then make an educated, adult, informed decision.
Right. All right. Well, I think that's probably enough on this subject.
Yeah, that makes my brain hurt. So,
if it hurts you, think of the rest of us, Bart.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, in fairness, what I will say about the Start SSL is that their instructions were actually very good. Because I just went in and started clicking next to stuff, and they said, now do this, and then do this, and then do this. And I was actually quite pleasantly surprised.
Oh, good. Okay. So once we get past that first hurdle, but I am sure we will hear from some people. People love to hear what more they can do to be secure in doing their WordPress stuff. That's for sure. Yeah. So, all right. Now, there's something you're excited about.
Yeah. As I say, I haven't been using Snow Leopard much, because until I got my new iMac, I didn't have Snow Leopard. So it's kind of hard to use it when you don't have it.
So it's all new to you.
So it's all new to me. And this, I think it was Friday, actually. I think it was late in the week. I decided to experiment with this whole services menu thing and using Automator to make my own services. So we should possibly do a little bit of a backtrack here. Ever since I started using OS X, which is starting at 10.3, and probably from very early on in OS X's history, every program, when you click on the main menu item for the programming, and you go down, you know, you have preferences and you have all of these standard things and quit at the bottom. But somewhere along there, there's always a menu called services.
And it was stupid.
It was utterly stupid.
It had like grab in there or something.
Yeah, well, I mean, every app you install has the potential, has the opportunity to provide services.
Right.
So if you've installed Smoltron, for example, which is an image editor, it puts itself in the services menu. Text Expander puts itself into the service menu.
Smoltron is a text editor, not an image editor.
Hmm?
You said Smoltron is an image editor. It's a text editor.
Oops, yes. Sorry.
Okay. Just so somebody wasn't confused.
Yeah, that would be quite confusing. Sorry for that. So they've always been this glop of services in here, and even when the services aren't available.
Glop it was. I was agreeing with you.
Yeah. Even when they're not available, they're there. They're just grayed out. And if they have like sub-elements, then the sub-elements are not grayed out. So you think, oh, goodness, there's something available here, until you hold your mouse over it and it expands. And then everything inside it is grayed out too.
It was such a tease.
It was such a tease. And it always struck me as something that had fantastic potential, but just did not work. And every time a new version of OS X came out, I was always disappointed that they did not do anything about it. They never fixed it until Snow Leopard, when they just completely reinvented the wheel on that one. Thank goodness.
Now, what exactly is a service? Describe that.
It's a small bit of functionality that's provided by some other program, but is available within the program you're in. So a simple service would be, if you highlight some text, you should be able to get OS X to speak it using the services menu.
Ah, okay. Right.
Because OS X has that ability.
That actually did work before Snow Leopard,
that was,
I think.
Yeah, that was one of the few things that worked if you could find it in the big glop.
Right. I do remember going, okay, I know I found this before. Where is it? And spending 10 minutes looking for it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's lots of useful things, but they were always hidden in there. So now the services menu only shows you stuff that actually works. And it breaks it down into stuff you can do to text and stuff you can do to images. And it's just become a lot more simpler to the point where now it's actually useful.
Cool.
So the other thing then, so that's one thing, and that's good. All by itself, that's just good. But it gets better, because there's also been another part of OS X that's been a little, it's had potential, but it hasn't really gone anywhere with it, and that's been Automator, which, if memory serves, was introduced in Tiger.
I think so, yeah. It's been around forever. And
it was introduced in Tiger.
A few people know how to use it.
Yeah, people are using it, but it was very 1.0 like when it was in Tiger, and there wasn't really that much done to it in Leopard.
So to describe to people what Automator is a way of creating scripts where you don't have to actually know how to do very much. It's kind of a drag and drop thing because, again, it's sort of like the services thing Bart's talking about where you have a set of things that you know someone might want to do in, say, Transmit, the FTP client. These are things that might happen. So they've created these little Automator scripts and you drag and drop and you got little pointers and you fill in little data and on them and stuff. It's very... It doesn't scare me, so it's not too bad.
So the phrase they use is that you create a workflow, and every workflow is just consists of a bunch of actions. And so you have a list of actions, which can be very large, and you can search them. There's a search box. And you just drag and drop the actions into your workflow, and then you build a program or a script, whatever you want to call it, that does something.
Right.
And you always actually had the ability to save them as system-wide scripts and to save them as folder actions and things, but it was never particularly easy. So the first thing you'll notice now when you fire up Automator is that you're presented with a window that gives you a list of all the cool things it can do, sort of like when you open up GarageBand and it says, would you like to create a podcast? Would you like to create... I don't know what else is in there because I never use anything else. But now when you open up Automator, you get a little window and it has a bunch of icons. And so you can create a folder action. You can create just a standard Automator workflow. You can create a service, which is the one that caught my eye. And there's a bunch more. There's about six of them, maybe eight in that window.
Right.
But the cool one is service. So you just say, okay, I'd like to make a service, please. And up comes your interface. And you then have some options at the top to say what, you know, a few little global options about your service you're making. Is it going to take images or text? You know, what is it going to take as input? And then is it going to replace whatever was there with what the service makes or not? And just a few check boxes and radio buttons right up at the very top. And they're really very simple and very self-explanatory. And then you just start dragging and dropping.
Right.
And then you hit save, and then your new service appears in the services menu.
Yeah, now there, I got to say, there's some tricky bits to this. So I decided that this service thing, one of the reasons I'd never done anything with Automator was I couldn't figure out what problem I needed to solve with it. So I'd go, wow, this is really cool. I should use this. And I didn't know what to solve with it. Every week in my podcast, I after I'm done recording, I share out the file as an AIFF file. And then I go through a very regimented set of steps that actually I should have given you the Automator script or the service. Now that I think about it, I should have given you the service because it would have done a lot of the handwork for you. But anyways, so yeah, that was dumb. Actually, you didn't have Snow Leopard yet, so
I didn't have Snow Leopard.
Yeah, yeah, that's why I didn't do it.
That's your excuse. Yeah, it's all good.
So anyway, it what this Automator script does for me, this service does for me now, is it opens it up in iTunes, it converts it to an MP3, it adds my tags, it adds my image, and it exports it back out as an MP3, and it shows me where the file is in my directory. So, it also levelates it before it gets started. But that script took 4 hours of Will's time helping me create it. Because there were pieces that were just missing. There were all these great things you could do in iTunes. You could add all the tags. You could add things like you could hit the checkboxes that say skip when shuffling and when you pause, remember the location. All those little things, except you couldn't add your image, and he had to write a script to do that, like with all kinds of funny characters and words and things I don't understand.
There is a phrase to learn to walk before learn to walk before you learn to run. I mean, you went straight for the big guns. You went straight for a very complex workflow.
I don't know. It could do everything but that one step. It did. It had the checkboxes for skip when shuffling. That's pretty advanced. It could do that out of the box. Why is that so advanced?
So the key point is it can do a lot. And where it particularly comes in is like the folder actions are particularly cool. If you maybe you have a bunch of images and you want to upload them to the web and you want to resize them all to a certain standard size that you always use, it's very easy to just drag and drop in a resize image action and just have it resize them all to 640 by 480 or something. I mean, that kind of stuff just all works out of the box without any particular need for you to do any icky scary programming. And Transmit provided a bunch of lovely actions so you could make it resize the folder and then upload it to your web server. So there's lots of really cool stuff that works out of the box. But at the end of the day, there's a finite number of actions and an infinite number of things you could want to do. So sooner or later, as you get more complex, you're going to hit the wall that Allison just described. I mean, you're going to bump into something someone hasn't thought of.
I will tell you that the end of the script was supposed to be and then uploaded to Transmit, and Will was never able to figure out how to get it to do it, which seems like the easiest step in the whole process because it's right there. It's right, but if we add that to the Automator script, it stops working. So I don't know. It's wonderful as long as what you want to do is in that list of little Automator scripts. If it's already in there, then you're good to go, and it's amazing. And if it's not in there, you're a living hell.
So this is where I disagree with you, because this is all right. If everything that's in there is like everything you want is in there, then it's a normal user feature, and if not, it becomes a really great power user feature. Because for me, the fun is in the fact that there's actions in there that allow me to drop in code.
Oh, yeah. I did describe a living hell. One man's living hell is another man's playground.
Okay, so for me as a programmer, I have a very different issue I have with stuff. I have skills that allow me to write scripts to do very cool things. And until now, those scripts have been in like a little prison, which is called the terminal.
Okay.
And I can write all my cool stuff, and then the only way I can interact with it is by typing stuff into the terminal. And that means that in reality, you end up not using your stuff a lot of the time. But with Automator, there's now an action to, say, execute shell script. And I can actually put my programming stuff straight into Automator and have it show up as a menu item in OS X.
Oh, that's cool.
I have now managed to insert my scripting skills into the GUI of OS X, which to me just blows my mind. That is just cool.
So I guess not from a normal person's perspective, from a fairly serious geek, not a mid-level geek, that is does sound fantastic.
It is fantastic. Now, it does have some knock-on effects as well. So you can do a lot of very cool stuff without ever needing to do this. And if you have a pet nerd, they can just create a workflow for you and send it to you, as you discovered.
Did you just call Will my pet nerd? I think he's going to get after you for that.
I think it's a compliment. I'm loads of people's pet nerd.
All right. Well, Will, I hope you take that as a compliment, as it was intended.
And George Starcher mentioned on Twitter that what he does when someone in his family calls him up and he's really not in the humor for a 20-minute, now click here, then click here, then click here, then there it is, no, that over there, no, look, open the oh, God. If he's not in the humor for one of those, he just writes an Automator script and emails them and says, now run that. How cool is that?
Okay.
But anyway, I want to give an example of how I fell in love with this whole thing. So in work, I look after a DHCP server, and it's running on Linux. And so it expects MAC addresses in the OS X, Unix, Linux type sort of way, which is a bunch of numbers in all lowercase separated by colons, which is how we're used to seeing them.
Okay.
But our network is full of those pesky Windows users. Sorry, Windows users. And Microsoft have a very different notion of all of this. Microsoft feel that a MAC address should consist of all capital letters separated by dashes.
So what do you do about that?
Oh, normally, what I would do is every time someone opens a call and copies in a Windows MAC address, I'd copy and paste it into where I manage the MAC addresses and then manually go and change all the dashes to colons and all the capital letters to lowercase letters, with the inevitable consequence that I make mistakes.
And how often do you have to do this?
A couple of times a day.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, it gets annoying.
Right.
So I figured to myself, I've got to be able to do this as a bleeding service now that I have this cool Snow Leopard thing. So it was easy to do. So I just made open up Automator, click service, drag and drop in the action that says get contents from clipboard, drag and drop. Drag and drop in the action that says execute shell script, drag and drop. And then drag and drop in the action that says put result to this clipboard, drag and drop that one in. So now we have a workflow that says whatever's in the clipboard gets sucked into my Automator action. I execute some Perl code on it, and then I put the result back in. And then I just copied and pasted in four lines of Perl that will simply change the things to the way I want. And now it's available as a menu option. So I've written a really simple little script, but I don't have to go anywhere near the terminal to execute it. I simply go to the services menu, and there it is. So now I just copy it in the call tracking system, convert it, and paste it.
Wow. And that's error-free now, too.
It's error-free, yeah.
Because the human's out of the component, right?
Exactly. And what I mean, that's nice. It's easy. It works. I also wrote another one to convert whatever text is in the clipboard to plain text, because I really hate when I copy something from a web page and paste it into something like Mail, that I get stupid formatting all over the place.
Oh, I want that one.
I'll send it to you then. Actually, I had to do that one in a very roundabout way.
See?
And that was a weird one, because I really thought someone would have written one, but it's actually quite easy to write in Action, so I might just write in Action. But what I ended up doing was running it through Perl, because Perl doesn't have formatting, so if I reprint it from Perl, all the formatting's stripped out.
Oh, okay.
So it's actually another very, very quick, to write little thing. But what I also noticed is that the actual interface has grown up a lot. Because it used to be quite difficult to see where stuff went wrong. But now there's a little triangle at the bottom of every chunk called Actions. And that lets you see, for a start, one of the important things is it describes what the action does. And it tells you what it takes for input and what it takes for output. Because what's probably going on with your script where it's not working with Transmit is that the output of the last action is probably not a file. And so Transmit isn't getting given a file, and therefore Transmit can't upload the file.
Right. Yeah, it could be. It's probably time to take another look at it.
Yeah, so if you expand it and look at the information, you can see what it takes in and what it spits out, which is very handy. But there's also another tab that's available there called Results, and it will actually show you the current thing it contains. So if you click the play button to run your action, you can actually watch the data dribble its way through your workflow and see its value at every point.
Yeah, I thought that worked really well. I thought they did a good job on that, where you can actually see it's telling you pretty exactly. Obviously what's wrong. How to fix it takes another 12 or 13 years, but...
Yeah, but if you can't see what's going on, it's almost impossible to fix. So as a programmer, when you're debugging something, information is king. You want to know what the value really is. You don't want to be assuming, well, I assume I've done this right, so therefore I'm assuming at this point in the flow it now has this value. Because the chances are your assumption is wrong. But if you can explicitly see it really does have this value, then it's very easy to debug. Because I had a slight typo in my Perl, and what was happening was I was ending up with nothing in the clipboard. And I could actually watch that, you know, the right values come from the clipboard, the right values get into my program, and nothing's come out. Oh, well, I know what the error is then. So, you know, I just think there's been a lot of polish added. And as a super user, it's just amazing to be able to take all of those cool Unix-level skills and put them straight into a GUI with minimal effort. And as a regular user, there's an awful lot in there that you can just do with dragging and dropping. And if you do run into a brick wall, because of the power of AppleScript, there's an awful lot that can be done if you can just find a friendly nerd to help out.
Yeah, I think for a super user, it's insanely cool. I think for a fairly uber geek, it's really cool. I think for a mid-level geek, it's a big old tease, because it gets me right to that point where I don't know how to do anything.
Yeah, but if you were to be doing slightly simpler things, I don't think you'd... I think it's very unfortunate that your first experience...
But I don't need to do any simpler things. I can't think of anything else that I need...
You know? I used to use Automator for backups, actually, which is kind of a handy thing to do, because you could take all the files you were interested in, stick them into a zip archive, and FTP them up to a server. And in fact, it even lets you connect to network shares. So what I actually did was I got all the files, created a zip file which contained today's date as the name, and then connected to a share, and then shoved the file to the share, and then disconnected from the share. And that was in the old version of Automator before it got cool.
Yeah, I guess... Somebody needs to show me, you know, give me a list of what are things that I do that could be automated with Automator, because I can't ever come up with anything that isn't complicated that I need to do. If it were complicated, I don't know. Haven't been able to crack into that. I did want to tell people in the show notes, there's a link over to Bart's blog post on this where he goes into quite a lot of depth about how this all works. But also I put in a link to pixelcore.tv where Alex Lindsay had Sal... Segoyan, I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
He had a master of AppleScript.
Right.
The guru of AppleScript.
Yeah, he had him on the show back in August, I think, where he walks through what these services are. I think it'd be really good to get a visual representation of what Bart and I have been talking about.
Yeah. The other thing we should say, in fairness to OS X, is that other operating systems don't have AppleScript. I mean, yeah, AppleScript is still programming. But it's programming really, really light because it's very, very Englishy.
Yeah. I can't write. It's sort of like, you know, I can listen to Italian and understand it, but I can't speak it. In this case, I can't do either, but you know what I mean? I can read it and I can go, okay, I kind of see what it's doing.
The other thing, of course, is that the internet is full of great little snippets of AppleScript code.
Yeah. Now, again, I thought, okay, I'm good on this whole thing. This will work out because I'll just go out. Someone has written an AppleScript that says, take the image artwork and drop it into iTunes. No, they haven't. No, I mean, hours I search. Well, it's so ironic because every other thing you want to do to the file exists in the Automator scripts, but that one thing.
That's a bit weird, actually. There you go. Yeah, I suppose the other thing is that if all else fails, what AppleScript actually has the ability to mimic key presses and mouse clicks. So if, you know, the program is written in a completely AppleScript-free way, you can actually describe a sequence of menu items and AppleScript will dutifully execute them as if you were doing it with a mouse. So on OS X, there's almost nothing can't be automated. And that puts it a step above any other operating system in my book.
Yeah, okay, so to make my counter-argument yet again, one of the big teases in Automator is there's a big button that says record. And I said, okay, great, I'll push record, I'll drag my artwork in, and I'll say stop recording, make that a script. That didn't work.
Yeah, that the record stuff works about as well as the record macro does in Microsoft Word.
Okay, good. Which, by the way, used to work. In Excel, like 15 years ago, man, I'd push record, I'd do a little action, I'd say stop record, it'd say good to go, name this, and I could run that little Excel macro over and over and over again. And now if you held a gun to my head, I couldn't record a macro.
Okay, I think I obviously joined at the gun to the head phase, because I've never in my life managed to get a macro to do anything.
Oh, it was beautiful. I used to use it all the time, and I don't know anything about scripting, so it had to have been easy. But not anymore. They improved it.
Oh no.
Well, let's see, is there anything else on this?
I think we've covered that pretty well.
Okay, and you do have a lot of you've put examples in your blog post where you've got pictures of what you did and some scripting and stuff.
Well, so I just worked through that one example of the MAC addresses in all the detail there is to walk through, which really isn't very much.
Right.
Because it's two lines of Perl code that have now been able to be beamed into the actual GUI.
But like I was saying, watching MacBreak is really good because you can see it. You can also see it in what Bart's done, at least in a screen snapshot. So that's kind of cool. You can see the little arrows and feed outs he's talking about. So very cool.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it really blew up my dress, I believe is your phrase.
Blew my dress up. Oh, but that ends in a preposition. I'll have to rethink that. Well, anyway, we have gone on forever here, Bart. I really appreciate it talking to you again this week. We on for next week?
We are indeed, and until then, happy computing.
Well, I guess we have to draw this show to a close, even though the chat room's going to start boo-hooing just about now. You really should join us sometime. It's a lot of fun in there. If you'd like to join in, it's really easy. Just go over to podfeet.com/live at 5 p.m. GMT-8 on Sundays. Now remember, if you're in, say, Australia or Indiana, that's actually Monday, but you do the math. If you do, you'll see my smiling face making mistakes and being chastised by the chat room. You can chat and text and help remind me to save in case my system freezes up too. That's a lot of fun. It's very welcoming and family friendly, so come in and join us sometime. In the meantime, be sure to keep those dumb questions coming, along with comments and suggestions, praise and criticism, by sending them along to allison@podfeet.com. And follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed. Okay, the chat room wouldn't let me take that out. I did not mean that Indiana is a day ahead of California in time zones. I meant India. They made me leave it in. It's not my fault.